Yesterday, we had a big deal in the travel space. Hyatt announcing a deal to acquire Apple Leisure Group for some $2.7 billion, bringing Hyatt into the luxury travel space as well as bringing it into the all-inclusive resort space. Joining us now to discuss the deal and the reshaping of the Hyatt portfolio, President and CEO at Hyatt, Mark Hoplamazy. And Mark, thanks so much for jumping on this morning. Let's just start with kind of how you guys thought about this deal in the context of one, a Hyatt that continues to change, you know, its portfolio structure, as you guys discussed on the call yesterday, but also with travel recovering, particularly leisure travel, and looking out, you know, to what the future of travel might be post-pandemic.
Thanks, Miles. Good to be here. Thanks for having me. First, I would say that leisure travel has been the most resilient and durable segment of the travel industry for a long time. It's not just a COVID and post-COVID phenomenon where we've seen tremendous recovery in leisure travel. It's also been the case after downturns in the past. You know, the power of human connectivity and human connection, where people want to reunite with family and friends and loved ones and actually take a break, has never been more important for obvious reasons. And so this is really something that we think is going to continue to be a segment with tremendous growth within the leisure segment. Resorts in particular and all-inclusive resorts are a very fast-growing segment in both the Americas and in Europe. We're going to be doubling our global resort presence upon closing this deal. We're adding over 100 resorts, and we're growing our footprint in Europe by 60%. So it's a really transformative deal in terms of the markets that we can cover.
Mark, it's Julie here. You guys have been transitioning to a more asset-light model. So how does then this deal kind of fit into that?
Yeah, it's actually, it really unlocks the next chapter of accelerated transformation to being an asset-light company. We started off life as a public company almost 12 years ago, and we were at a two-thirds, one-third split of earnings. Two-thirds of our earnings came from owned and leased hotels, and one-third came from our fee business. By the time we close the deal and finish a additional $2 billion sell down of assets that we announced yesterday, we will be at a 20-80 split, 20% from owned and leased and 80% from fees. And that's by 2024. So it really is quite a significant unlock. And aside from reducing the earnings from owned and leased hotels, this is really an asset-light business that we're buying. So it's all fee-based income. So it really is transformative from a mix of earnings perspective.
And then, Mark, I venture you don't make an acquisition of this size if you don't have some form of visibility into your business over the next 12 to 18 months. What are you seeing for 2022 booking trends?
Well, what I would tell you is that the best visibility that we have is in group business. That's the longest lead time booking curve. And the 2022 progression was tracking at about 15% below 2019 levels. And we have an expectation, that we'll see more bookings come through on the group side. So we see that happening, and that group business is not strictly corporate and association. There are leisure groups, there are sports groups, and other specialty groups. That's the best visibility we have into bookings for next year. But I'll tell you that the momentum that we've seen through July has been remarkable in leisure. The luxury leisure segment in particular is particularly durable because a lot of our core customer base have the means to be able to travel, and it is the first thing that they've turned to. So I would say that we do expect leisure and business to be vibrant into next year. For the next few months, a little harder to say because, of course, people are still contending with the variability of the Delta variant and coping with that. But we see this really as a trend, longer term trend, and something that we're looking forward to for the next 5 to 10 years.
Have you seen any cancellations of late because of that you can tie to the COVID variant?
The most acute downturn that we've seen due to Delta is in China. The playbook that the Chinese government has used when they've had outbreaks of this type is to be very aggressive about limiting travel and limiting activity, actually. So there are very, very strict restrictions on movements. And in China, we've seen a very precipitous drop in bookings. Our experience in history with that is that subsequent to those extensive restrictions, demand recovers quickly because you end up with sort of a compressed pent-up demand that springs into the future. And then in terms of bookings into August, so sort of more real time, we have seen some declines. And I think part of that was in the Caribbean, at least due to the tropical storm that was threatening to be a hurricane. Fred, I think they named it. And then apart from that, I surmise that there are some Delta variant impacts at this point. Again, you know, we do expect, especially given our training from the last 18 months, that this is not a smooth road and we're going to be managing through and having to continually adapt and pivot.
Like all of us, for sure, Mark. Finally, I want to circle back to the deal and ask you one more question about that, which is that you guys are taking on $1 billion in debt to buy Apple Leisure. S&P said that you might be subject to a debt downgrade as a result. What effect would that have if your bonds were downgraded to junk in terms of your borrowing ability going forward?
Well, S&P is one of the rating agencies that rates Hyatt. We have two other ratings, and I think the other rating agencies have been more optimistic and supportive, I guess. I think the thing that I would say is that we got $2 billion of assets that we've committed to sell. The market for hotel assets, especially of the quality that we have, has been very robust. So we have many, many alternatives as to how we can ultimately raise capital and pay down debt over time. We have cherished our investment grade profile since the time, actually well before the time we were public and as a company. And so my view is that we've always run a conservative balance sheet. And while we are taking on additional debt, in the short term, we expect to be able to pay it down and then some over the next 3 years as we sell down assets.
And then, Mark, just finally, on the asset sales, I'm just curious who's coming to you guys and wants to buy it. We hear so much about, you know, dry powder out there. Are these, you know, what's the buyer profile, I guess, of the folks that you're talking to? And again, you know, as you guys mentioned, $2 billion more of asset sales expected by 2024.
Yeah. So first of all, REITs are active, public REITs, and private REITs are active. There are several large private REITs that focus on hotel acquisitions. And then both private equity, private investment groups, as well as foreign sovereign funds that support principals in the marketplace. So it really is from a variety of different sources, which is another reason why we're confident that we're going to be able to execute really well. We're completing, since 2017, when we announced that we would start selling down assets, by the end of this year, we expect to have sold over $3 billion of assets at a 17.4 times EBITDA multiple, which is well above what we predicted. So we have a track record, and this is an incremental $2 billion, and we think we're very confident we're going to be able to execute against that.
All right, we'll leave it there. Appreciate the time this morning. Mark Hoplamazian, CEO and President at Hyatt. Talk to you soon, Mark. Thanks. All right, welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live on this Tuesday morning. We've talked about it here on the program, written about it on Yahoo Finance. 2020 and 2021 been a huge year for the golf business and professional golf, wrapping up its regular season. Last week, playoffs beginning this week at Liberty National. And joining us now to talk about everything happening in the world of golf is the top-rated golfer in the world, John Rahm, joining us from Liberty National in Jersey City. John, appreciate you taking some time to talk with us this morning. I want to start out on tour, Bitcoin. People talking about it? What are you guys chatting about? You guys are out there killing some time. Everyone's got some extra cash. What's the financial world looking like to you guys?
It is something you hear. I know one player on the PGA Tour who invested with some friends, not friends, some friends of his, and they do have a warehouse with over 2,000 computers mining Bitcoin. And he was telling me how much of a gold mine that was going to be. I'm not going to lie. I don't think I know I'm not in any cryptocurrency currently. I know I probably might have missed a big opportunity in there, but at the same time, you know, I'm blessed to do what I do. Luckily, we have the opportunity to play for a lot of money, and as I'm still young, I'm gonna focus on that, and then, well, maybe in the future when I've saved up enough, I might start thinking about investing it. But it is something some people talk about. The cryptocurrency is something it's a conversation that goes on.
Well, don't worry, John. You got a lot of playing in front of you, and there'll be a lot of people telling you that this is the next big thing many times over the years. So, you know, crypto one thing, it'll be something else in the future. You know, I'm curious, like, does this feel like one long season to you going from the restart last year? Because as a fan following tour, six majors just in this season, it has kind of felt like a nonstop grind for you guys. Does it seem that way to you?
Well, it is a longer season. You know, you see the added points and everything to a little bit more than usual. You know, people have had more chances. And since there's been so many big events, you kind of see, you know, the different streaks. People that play good earlier, play good later, but they still stayed up there in the rankings, right? But I think for the people having playing good golf, it's going to be a better year every year because you have more big tournaments, more opportunities, more to play for, right? So it's something that's unique. The other day I was just thinking, man, I just realized how far away the next major is, which is Augusta in April, right? Because I kind of gotten used to playing one every 1 or 2 months. It's been nice to have that little bit of a little break going on between majors, and now we're not going to be able to see another one till April. So I'm going to miss having a year like this many majors counting.
Yeah, and you know, John, I wonder about peaking. You know, for you guys, how you think about it. You know, we just had the Olympics, right? And swimmers and runners, they spend 4 years and they just get ready for this one event. But you guys, you know, you have big events 4 months in a row in the spring. Ryder Cup's coming up next month. How do you think about peaking, or do you just say, "Well, I'm playing good golf now. I'll just focus up and try to ride that wave."
I mean, I'm not going to speak for other players, but in my case, when I'm deciding what to do with the schedule, obviously we look at the four majors first, right? You have the four majors in the FedEx Cup. Those are the highlights of the year. You got a peak in each one of those. And it's a little different because leading up to Augusta, you have time. You might have a time off, and then you have 3 months of competition before Augusta. And then basically you have a major every month, right? So you have to be able to peak and those events. And I think more of it is training accordingly, and then after each one being able to get enough rest to get ready for the next one. And that's kind of how I think about it, right? Try to tailor the strength and condition into that, and what tournaments you play and don't play in order to be ready for each one of those. That's kind of how it goes, at least in my mind. Now, if you're playing good golf and you feel like you can ride it a little bit longer, I know people do that and maybe play more events because they feel like they're playing good and they like to keep going instead of going home. But in my case, I rarely change my schedule to add more tournaments. If anything, I'm taking them off and, you know, playing maybe a different time of year.
John, I last talked to you in 2019, I believe just before you got married, and you were playing great then. Mm-hmm. But since then, I would say you have hit a next gear. You've had top 10 finishes in all four majors this year. You won your first major this year. What do you attribute you hitting that next level? How have you done it?
It's a learning curve once you become a pro, right? Even though when I turned pro, I started playing really good golf right away. There was a lot of maturing and growing up to do in that sense, mainly on the golf course more than off the golf course, but still a lot of learning in general, right? I mean, you go from college where business we're in the financial channel right now, where you're basically broke as hell, at least in my case, and then turn pro and start playing really good golf and signing these contracts. There's a lot of getting used to, right? Dynamics change when it comes to families and things change, and things change within yourself, right? So there's a lot of getting used to that. And then getting married was a big milestone for me that, you know, that really helped me in that sense, and having stability at home, and then becoming a father has been the cherry on top, right? I think that's what put a lot of things together. I've had a great life off the golf course. I can't complain, but this is taking it to another level, right? And I'm one of those players who I'm not happy because I'm playing good golf. I play good golf because I'm happy. And it correlates, right? The better my personal life is and the better my home life is, the better I play golf. And most of my mental work, believe it or not, comes to, you know, it's work that I do off the golf course, trying to be a better friend, a better son, a better father, and a better husband. And so far I've done a pretty good job. And that's what I keep doing. And I think that's what I attribute that next level, right? It's been incredible. That experience of becoming a father has been amazing. I can say after seeing what a woman goes through those months of pregnancy and delivery, I got a whole new appreciation for my wife. And that definitely changed a lot of things, right? I've told her even before in person, you know, what she gave us, which is going through that and delivering our son, it's something I could never repay. There's nothing I can do to get even close to something like that. So I think that's what made me, you know, just play better golf. Feel like, again, not that golf takes a second page, but there's more important things in life, right? And it makes it easier to channel all my energy to practice. And then, you know, I get home and I'm dad, you know, it's almost easier to get a break from it. And it's been really nice.
Yeah, John, how is, you know, being a first time dad, how has that changed how you approach preparing for tournaments? And how has it just changed your outlook on the game?
It doesn't change the way I play. It doesn't change the way I think on the golf course. It just helps me get over things quicker. Especially when I'm done, like whether I have a good or bad day, 10, 15 minutes after, it's gone. Especially if Kelly and my son are there on the golf course, as soon as I see them, it's out of my mind. It's whatever. I might go to the range trying to fix some things if I play bad, but it won't get, you know, my ego won't get too high if I play good, and it won't be too low either if I play bad, right? It's just, it's almost like once I hold my son or I see Kelly and I hug her and give her a kiss, it's a before and after, right? Once that happens, golf is over. I'm a normal person, you know, I'm a husband, I'm a dad, I have those duties. Right before that, I'm still the golfer, right? So I think that's the transition to off golf, John, let's say it that way, just being a, you know, not an athlete, just a family man, is what's helped me the most with. It's a quick transition, and it's a very nice feeling, to be honest, especially every time I see the little guy, even at the US Open, right? When I held him after making that putt on 18, it's just for a second I forgot where I'm at, you know, I forgot what I was doing. I forgot what happened. I forgot what I had coming, right? So it was, that's the blessing that they give you.
All right. Appreciate the time. Number one ranked golfer in the world, fifth in the Comcast Business Tour Top 10 heading into the playoffs. John Rahm, appreciate the time. I'll tell you, have fun at the Ryder Cup. I can't wish you luck. I'll tell you to have fun and we'll see. We'll see how things shake out.
John, I know what you all mean by that. It's okay. Thank you.
That's all right.
All right, switching gears here now. Pro golfer Patrick Cantlay is celebrating finishing the end of the regular season as one of the coveted Comcast Business Tour top 10 athletes as he heads into this week's FedEx Cup playoffs, which tee off tomorrow in New Jersey with the Northern Trust. And we are delighted to have Patrick Cantlay with us right now. Congratulations, Patrick, on your third place finish there in the Comcast Business Tour top 10. Tell us what's on your mind. How are you feeling heading into the Northern Trust tomorrow?
Yeah, I think it's great. Start of the playoffs, and no better place than up here, New Jersey, New York area. And we played the tournament up here a few years ago, and I like it a lot. So should be a good week. It's always exciting this time of year. The golf, the stakes are up, and it should be fun.
And exciting also because I believe you're going to be having some fans there, right, for the first time in a very long time since this pandemic. Tell me what you're expecting. What kind of energy do you expect to get from the folks that are going to be in attendance?
I think it should be great. Every time I'm in the New York area, I think, you know, I remember the PGA at Bethpage, the New York fans are fantastic, and they just add a little more excitement to the tournaments that are up in this area. And so it is nice to have the fans back, and I think that's such a great part of sports, and, you know, I'm really looking forward to getting the week started tomorrow.
Now, I know that your full-time caddy, Matt Minister, had tested positive for COVID-19, so he will not be there at Northern Trust for you. But You do have a pretty good backup, Tiger Woods caddy, Joe Cava, going to be substituting for, I guess it's a substitution gig there, this week only. Talk to me about working with Joe, and have you worked with him before?
Yeah, Joe's never caddied for me before, but, you know, I obviously know Joe a little bit and spent some time with him at President's Cup, and he's a great dude and obviously a very good caddy. He's been doing it, I think he said, almost 35 years. And so, you know, he knows what he's doing, and he's a great replacement. So I couldn't ask for a better replacement. My caddy should be back next week, and I'm looking forward to Matt coming back next week.
Absolutely. And I know that you and Tiger Woods have grown quite close. Of course, Tiger still sidelined as he rehabs from that car accident in February. But I'm curious if you've talked to Tiger heading into the playoffs this week.
Yeah, we texted a little bit, and I just thanked him for letting me use Joe this week and letting him off. You know, Tiger and I spent a little time. We both live Jupiter area, and we got close really for the first time President's Cup. He was the captain there when we went to Melbourne for the President's Cup, and he did such a marvelous job that week and really bonded with the guys. And, you know, we've played a little golf since then, and he's just a great dude. So we can't wait to get him back and get him back and healthy.
Patrick, I've got to ask you a money-related question here because you are on Yahoo Finance. And with a lot of these tours, there can be a nice purse associated with them. Of course, there are endorsement-type opportunities. I'm just curious, when you think about money, what's your priority in your life? And do you have an investing philosophy at all, Patrick?
Well, I'd say I'm only 29 years old, and so I try to take a very long-term approach. I wonder, with all the enormous spending out there, you know, what's going to be left for my generation in 25 years. So that's a little concerning. But in general, I try to be very long term and fairly conservative. And it's definitely a big, wide world out there that I'm getting more and more knowledgeable about. And so I try to really get some mentors in that area. And Marcus is a great outlet for me to learn more about that, my relationship with Marcus Goldman Sachs. And so, you know, I feel like I'm always learning. And so it's really exciting to feel like I'm being able to know more about it as I kind of get older.
Mm-hmm. That's a prudent approach there, Patrick. Patrick Cantlay, thanks so much for joining us, for making time for us. I know you have a busy week, and best of luck at the Northern Trust.
Ticker symbol DNUT, or Donut, is in focus today on the Yahoo Finance platform. That's after the owner of that ticker, Krispy Kreme, issued better-than-expected full-year sales guidance. The company did, however, miss second-quarter analyst earnings estimates by a penny, despite seeing strong demand for its hot, soft donuts. Joining us now is Krispy Kreme CEO Mike Tattersfield. Mike, good to talk with you again here. I still don't think investors understand what you're doing with this hub-and-spoke model, where I believe, if I have it right, you order donuts online and you have it delivered from a location. Is that a profitable model? And take us through how you're expanding that.
No, so it's great to chat again, Brian. Good to see you. I really appreciate being able to chat with all the folks. Q2's performance was one of the best quarters that we've had as a public company, as we just came back. We just went public a little over a month ago. And it's really driven by two pieces. One, I'll get at the hub and spoke, but the first is just a global transformation, where we actually now own six countries, and also 85% of the U.S. The second part of that transformation allows to do exactly what you say is the hub and spoke system. So we rely on our theater shops, those hot light shops that a lot of the people around the world know, and then bring the hot donuts or bring fresh donuts to where the customers are, in a fresh model distribution system. So really pushing on what I call points of access. And that's very different than what we used to do before. So it's getting points of access in an urban location. It might be in a fresh shop. It also might be in a grocer, and it might be in a convenience shop. And that also unlocks e-commerce. So that's very different than our past, which was a very typical franchisor model, and just building out hot lights everywhere. We actually value scarcity, and the model now is really about you know, producing amazing donuts, especially the original glaze, and then making sure that we can get it fresh to where the customers are. That's the difference in the model. And you can see it in the international business, which has actually been developing this omni-channel model ahead of us. And that's what we call it. And it's part of the hub and spoke is part of it. And it was built and designed that way. And their profitability that you can see in Q2 was significant because the frequency from the points of access, including our hot light shops, really worked. And you can see that in the performance.
It's also a different model, Mike, relative to a lot of your competitors. Are you gaining more shelf space in the likes of a Walmart and other grocery stores?
Well, the fresh model, we're starting to be, you know, here's the reality. The fresh will continue to build our model, and it'll be long-term 5 to 10% ACV. So you got to think of our company a little differently. It's more of a hybrid CPG company with these amazing hot light shops that can do, you know, hot donuts, glazing and different flavors at that point, and then getting them to the point of access. The growth is going to be primarily through the grocery and convenience channels. We look at probably, we're going to do about 800 to 1,000 points of access on a yearly basis. And we've identified even the 30 countries, including the U.S. where we have today, about 6,000 points of access growth in front of us.
You know, Mike, I think an asset that is in the business that perhaps people were reacquainted with through the public process is Insomnia Cookies. And I'm curious what that showed you in the second quarter. And as I associate Insomnia, I think about it from my college years. I associate it with a college campus or a college town. And, you know, is that business maybe poised to have a stronger back half of the year with a return to more normalcy on, you know, most college campuses in the U.S.?
Yeah. So Insomnia is just a great, we took a majority stake and the partner, you know, the owner, founder, Seth, stayed with us and he's really leading the team and it's an amazing job. They did incredible last year as they evolved their business. They are e-commerce, primarily driven business, which is about 50% of it is. And they evolved into gifting and delivery as their main vehicle, even when colleges were in a hybrid state. So we see they just crossed their 200th cookie shop opening. And yes, we see as colleges return back to normal, we can see growth there. But the omni-channel model, both in Krispy Kreme and in Insomnia, just shows you the strength. Because even under last year, when it was really challenging to operate under the pandemic in both our brands, they had great years.
Mike, you didn't punt this question on the earnings call regarding inflation. You did say you are seeing significant inflation, oils, sugars, and that you are taking a price increase in September. How much more will it cost me to buy a Krispy Kreme donut in September?
You know, we're really disciplined on pricing. We're a dozens business, right? So, you know, we do always pay attention to an accessible price point. So when you think about the pricing that will happen in a dozen, you won't really see it that much, right? We do sell dozens. We sell in occasions. We see the shift happening naturally, you know, as people upgrade. For example, you just were mentioning, you know, our s'mores donuts, right? Where they're a higher priced donut. So within the balance of mix and price, it's got to be worth it, right? And as long as we can keep it, you know, you'll still see some price point around $1 per individual donut when you're looking at a dozen if you're buying original glaze. Somewhere around there, that doesn't mean we only hold at $1. We'll continue to look at. We do have pricing power. We're really thoughtful. And we think about it around the globe, right? That's one of the unique things about being a celebratory brand. And if people love you across all continents, and now we have a business model, which is pretty clear from the hot light theater shops to points of access, and then making sure that we can move our dozens of business, our donuts. And then they're used in celebratory occasions. They're used you know, all over the world for a pretty interesting aspect that the consumer wants to engage and enjoy.
Hey, Mike, it's Julie here. When you're talking about it's a dozens business, when people are coming into the store, how often are they buying a dozen versus a single donut? And then when you shift on over to delivery, what kinds of trends are you seeing there? Because I imagine, I mean, I don't know if you have a delivery minimum for people who are ordering from home, but it seems like margins are already tight on delivery. If you're just buying a donut and a coffee, that, you know, it's not going to be worth a lot to you guys.
So because the brand is used a lot for occasions, and as how people will celebrate and use our brand, which is pretty unique in its own right, about 75% of our donuts are sold in primarily in dozens. So that's a pretty unique aspect of that. That carries over as well into delivery. So we don't see one donut order. We see a dozen, sometimes even a two dozen order.
Mike, you're seeing on the screen those Hershey's donuts. Definitely, I would say innovation from you guys. What else do you have on tap from the menu innovation front? I know coffee has been a big focus by you as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're a donut company. That's one of the unique things that we really focus on and the change in the brand, because everybody asks, so what's different? You know, I think I talked about last time, our focus on donuts and how we use even an innovation and to drive frequency. Last year, we sold 1.3 billion donuts. Since June 30th this year, we're at 750 million donuts. So the focus is about donuts and their occasion. That's where we spend our time and energy. That's what's really driving the brand. The growth is there. It's a frequency of getting to the points of access, the right innovation, and then locking e-commerce, which you can also get into gifting as well. So it's a pretty unique aspect of what we try to do. Beverages can play a role, but they play a role primarily in urban locations where we'll have a fresh shop, right, where someone will come in for beverage. But the old model of building a coffee shop, a franchisee, franchisor model is not the model that we use today. And you can see the profitability and the change of the model in our more mature omni-channel model, which is our international business. And we just see tremendous growth opportunity, not just in the 30 countries we're in, but we proven this model works in all these continents, and we're actually now really looking at new geographies. In fact, tomorrow we'll open up in Egypt with our partner out in the Middle East. You know, that's a population of 100 million in the country and 20 million in Cairo. So we just see, again, the accessible part of our brand. It focuses on donuts. The different channel approaches will have different product mixes, but it is a focus on doing donuts. 93% of what we sold in our retail shops were donuts.
Mike, real quickly, before we let you go, you mentioned you're opening in Egypt. You're making a big international push. I'm sure you have seen what's going on in Afghanistan. Does that push internationally into other Middle East countries, does that change the risk profile of a Krispy Kreme?
We use, again, partners in other parts of the world. So Americana is our partner there. They're one of our most successful franchisees. When we put our own capital in play, we'll do that. The world is continuing looking for our brand. That won't change how we continue to think about it. It's making sure the brand, from its essence, is to drive a joy and enhance the lives of others through Krispy Kreme. If we can do that in any country and if partners, and we see a lot of folks really wanting to open up, we're just going to be really disciplined about how we expand international.
Fair enough. At the rate I'm going, my vacation might be to one of your stores to watch some donuts being made. It's been a heck of a year. We'll leave it there.
Brian, and always, I thank all the Krispy Kremers for always just doing an incredible job across the globe for us.
You got it. Krispy Kreme CEO Mike Tattersfield. Have a good rest of the week.
Take care.
Well, leaders from nearly 200 countries are gathering in Glasgow this fall to come up with a collective plan to tackle climate change. The UN conference known as COP26 will call on countries to get ambitious targets to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions by the middle of the century. And for the biggest emitters like the U.S., there is added pressure to financially help developing countries develop their low carbon footprint. To discuss that, let's bring in Jake Levine. He is U.S. International Development Finance Corporation's Chief Climate Officer, a new role here at the agency. We've also got Yahoo Finance's R.T. Swaminathan joining in on the conversation. Jake, it's great to talk to you. You know, for those who are not familiar necessarily with what the DFC does, it's the government arm that helps develop these, help finance private development in developing countries. A lot of questions around the U.S. commitment in helping a lot of the poorer countries reach these broader goals. How do you prioritize these projects by region
and specifically by, you know, the types of projects the U.S. is looking to finance?
Sure. Thanks, Akiko. And hi, Aarti. It's great to be with you guys to talk about this important subject. A lot going on in the lead up to COP26, and we're going to be a big part of that. Just to give you a little bit of context, the DFC, the Development Finance Corporation, is basically America's development bank. We were authorized in 2018 under legislation in Congress called the Build Act to invest up to $60 billion in low and low to middle income countries around the world. And we have a whole array of financial tools to do that. We work with debt financing and project finance. We do equity investments, both in direct equity investing and also through the use of funds. And we now really importantly have a new technical assistance capability, which particularly when we're talking about climate in developing economies is critical to the work of actually ensuring that projects can become feasible and can meet the various sort of technical capabilities that we need them to meet, whether it's an energy project, transportation, buildings, decarbonization, industrial nature-based solutions, sort of across the gamut. And in terms of what we're doing on climate, the Biden administration has really focused its efforts overseas in ensuring that the U.S. is playing a leadership role, both within the context of the UNFCCC and the COP26 meetings coming up in Glasgow, and also more broadly through the G7 and the G20. DFC is sort of taking the lead on that climate piece. We have committed to investing at least one third of our overall portfolio in climate-linked investments. We committed to being net zero as a financial institution by the year 2040, which is the most ambitious net zero commitment of any of the major economies' development finance institutions. And we've rolled out, as I sort of alluded to earlier, mm-hmm. this key technical assistance facility, $50 million over 5 years. Happy to go into more detail on any of that.
So, Jake, going back to the question of how you pick your priorities when you've got this grand goal, really, I mean, there's a long list of projects that need to be pursued. How big of a factor does the competition with China play into that at a time when they are investing billions of dollars in emerging economies?
Well, it's important. I mean, look, the DFC is very affirmatively seeking to provide an alternative to the type of financing that China provides through its Belt and Road Initiative. You know, China has engaged in certain development finance practices that are more in line with the type of practices that you see coming from authoritarian governments. You see other recipient governments oftentimes pressured to take on this type of sort of debt trap financing. And the US government, working with its partners through the G7, is providing a values-based alternative focused on sustainability, not just on climate sustainability, but on financial sustainability, and focused on making investments that are ultimately good for the countries where we are providing investment. So that includes bringing up basic environmental and social and labor standards in line with US and American values and the types of values that we don't see coming from other types of investors like China and others.
Jake, for a developing country, when they're considering costs, there is tendency to focus on something that's established, like coal, fossil fuels. But how has that conversation changed? Are countries more receptive to receiving DFC, you know, as you move into this new administration?
Absolutely. And, you know, this also plays into this question of sort of where are we prioritizing our work? And as you're likely well aware, the U.S. is driving a number of really positive, both bilateral and multilateral conversations in the context of the UNFCCC. So our discussions with other nations such as Indonesia, South Africa, Brazil, India in particular, in terms of their specific transitions, energy transitions away from heavily polluting fossil energy and towards clean energy. And when we come into the market, it creates sort of the possibility for the private sector to follow on. This is core to our mission, is to be able to de-risk investments that would otherwise provide too high of a risk for the private sector to want to follow on and crowd in terms of our investments. And we're now seeing that the market is clearly headed towards clean energy. I think on the previous segment, you talked about on a previous segment, you had talked about just the record amount of investment that we're seeing into climate, whether that's on the venture side or private equity or from institutional investors. And what we're focused on doing is sort of accelerating that transition in the markets where it's hardest to do and where it's been the slowest so far because of various market specific risks.
And just linking back to the developments that are happening with regards to Afghanistan, you mentioned the Belt and Road. There is a very key part that Afghanistan has to play because of its proximity to Pakistan, which is a big partner for China. How is the DFC thinking about these developments? I know that, you know, obviously there might not be investments there, but what is going on with the thinking there? I'm curious.
DFC, you know, we are focused on providing development value in the toughest environments where it is most difficult to provide private financing. And so a lot of times you see that happening in countries that have been navigating really incredibly the hardest, most challenging problems, such as a conflict, migration, civil war. And we look forward to the opportunity to evaluate specific transactions that can help drive the American development agenda in those countries and particularly around the world in the most difficult situations.
And Jake, finally, as we look ahead to COP26, there is a sort of this nagging question about U.S. credibility on the issue of climate. The U.N. has consistently pointed out that that $100 billion commitment that was placed by developed countries back in 2009, that commitment still hasn't been met. What do you say to those countries who say, how do we know that the U.S. is all in? And how do you rebuild the U.S. credibility on this very issue?
It's a great question. It's a really important question, Akiko. And I just want to reassure some of those countries and partners and allies that this is a central area of our focus. We are working day in and day out to ensure that the developed economies, including with the U.S. in the lead, can actually keep that commitment that we made in 2009 at the Copenhagen COP. And that we are working hard to accelerate the degree to which we're able to provide financing and help to reach that $100 billion goal. It is key, as you note, because in nations around the world that are still developing, they're experiencing a convergence of both coping with the impacts of climate change and also experiencing their own emissions on the rise. And so it's incumbent upon countries like the United States and our partners in the OECD to be providing financing to help navigate that transition and support the work of developing economies.
Well, Jake, we hope to keep the conversation going with you. Jake Levine, U.S. International Development Finance Corporation Chief Climate Officer, and our very own R.T. Swaminathan as well. Thanks.
Earnings season is wrapping up, which means it has been a big week for the retail sector. Walmart, Target, among the major reporters out of the retail industry over the last several days. Joining us now to talk about the state of that industry and everything else happening in retail, Jan Rogers Niffen. He's the CEO of J. Rogers Niffen Worldwide Enterprises. Jan, always great to have you on the program. Let's start with just some of these results we've gotten out from the last, some of these big retailers. I mean, we have Target and Walmart telling us that their best months of the quarter were July, as we have all this consternation about the health of the recovery. How are you thinking about the retail industry and its position in the economy today?
Through yesterday, sales are still great. Nobody's talked about sales slowing down in August. People that did say anything about it said August was good. Even Children's Place came out and they said, maybe July wasn't quite as strong as we thought, but we've been going crazy here in August. So back to school is going really, really well. It started early. It's continuing to just explode, and it's going to run long. There is nothing wrong with the consumer from the point of view of the ability to spend or the willingness to spend. And so far, they haven't stepped away from my kind of retail. They may have stepped away a little bit from restaurants, but they're showing no inclination to stop spending on discretionary retail, apparel, clothes, shoes, all that sort of stuff is going really, really well. They pulled back a little bit on DIY, but that was just the normal rotation. That's been fabulous. And now we're starting to go places again. We're thinking about going back to the office. We're thinking about going on vacation. And when we do that, we buy apparel, clothes, and shoes. And that's still happening really, really well right through yesterday.
Jan, you think we're set up for a blowout holiday season?
We will have the best back to school in history, and we will have the best holiday in history, despite supply chain issues, despite the ports being backed up. We are still going to have a fabulous holiday. I'm telling you, if you want to buy it, it is not going to get cheaper on Black Friday or Cyber Monday, and it will be gone if you don't go ahead and buy it, because that's what inventories look like today. Gross margins will be the best we've ever seen for holiday. People will run out of merchandise in some cases. That may constrain sales a smidge, but earnings will be fabulous because we're not going to see any downward pressure due to unplanned markdowns.
Jan, it's Julie here. Why isn't the Delta variant more of an issue? I mean, we're hearing it from airlines, right? We're hearing it from some travel companies. So there are segments of the economy that are being affected by this thing. Why isn't retail seemingly being affected?
Well, maybe it is being affected, but it's growing so fast right now that you can't see it if it's being affected. So if it is, it's being overwhelmed by people's desire to go back and buy stuff. So we can't see it because traffic got better in the first week of August than it's been since COVID started. And it got better than that in the second week of August. So we're certainly not seeing it in foot traffic, and online businesses continued to be good, better than I thought it could hold up even. And I was one of the most optimistic people on online businesses. So we're still seeing the consumer spend. Why is that? The consumer's sitting on $2 trillion worth of excess savings. They don't have any problems with their credit cards right now. Their asset base is rising. Employment's getting better. You just saw the record employment numbers. So what is there to slow the consumer down other than being afraid? And right now, they're not afraid enough of COVID-D in the shopping environment, it appears, to have slowed them down. I don't think it's going to, because what we're seeing is infections, hospitalizations, and deaths among unvaccinated people. People like me who don't want to get it know that if we do get it, we're getting a bad cold, maybe. And I think people have started to internalize that because they're sure not hesitating to go to the malls. They're not hesitating to go to the strip centers. They're out shopping, and they certainly didn't hesitate to go to Walmart or Target, and they haven't up through yesterday. And if they were going to, one would have thought they might have started. We're also not seeing hoarding, by the way, like we did when this all started.
Jen, speaking of the malls, if you're a mall executive at a Nordstrom, Macy's, Dillard's, you name it, all those stores that are still open, should you be quaking in your boots that an Amazon might be opening a 30,000 square foot store somewhere in the U.S.?
Well, I don't think so. I have been saying since 2014 that Amazon needed 1,000 stores to continue to be growing and competitive in the marketplace. Amazon does half of the online business. They do virtually nothing in stores, as far as an important number. And they need that growth to continue to compete with the Walmarts and the Targets. And so Amazon, yes, is a great online retailer, but so far they've been a pretty terrible brick-and-mortar retailer. None of the stores that you've been in, I'm sure, set your heart aflame. And they haven't done much with Whole Foods. So they need to learn that business. I've been saying all along, and I've been saying this since 2014 as well, they should be out buying Kohl's. They'll get their 1,000 stores in one fell swoop. They'd have a management team that could run them. They could put anything they wanted to in them. And the stores are probably right now on average 25,000 square feet bigger than they need to be. So they could certainly be many distribution centers and customer service centers. And they're already doing business with Kohl's. So why they would want to greenfield and start building 30,000, 30,000, 30,000 and try to get to the 1,000 stores they need is a mystery to me, but it looks like that's what they're going to do. But when they do, now they've got to learn to run that business. And that's going to be a long process. So I wouldn't be quaking in my boots, but I'd sure be paying close attention. Because after all, they've got all the capital in the world. They've got all kinds of talent. and they can do anything they want to do. They just haven't done brick and mortar very well so far.
Yeah, certainly. To say their heart hasn't been in it might be a little bit of an understatement. We'll see if Amazon's new leadership changes things up there. Jan Rogers Niffen with J. Rogers Niffen Worldwide. Jan, appreciate the time as always. I know we'll be in touch.
Thank you.